I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Welcome to the Lazy CEO podcast. I'm Jane Liu. Join my conversations with the entrepreneurs behind the iconic brands we all know and love. Hey, Potty fam. Today I'm chatting with Tim Fong, the co-founder of Airtasker. If you're lazy like me, you've definitely used Airtasker a lot. Actually, we do discuss on the pod, it's not laziness, it's being efficient and creative. Anyway, my point is Airtasker is Australia's largest digital marketplace for local services. Airtasker has achieved 6.7 million verified reviews of tasks completed across the platform, and in 2022 achieved $44 million in revenue with 40% year-on-year growth. Tim has been very busy in recent years, from going public in 2021, acquiring one of their competitors, Oneflare, who is number three in the market, and launching in the US and UK. We talk about the challenges that come with building a two-sided marketplace, how he achieved profitability, which is by no means easy for a tech business, especially marketplaces, as well as the challenges in today's tougher economic environment. And I especially love his startup story that led him to starting Airtasker. Honestly, I could have talked to Tim all day. Well, let's get into it. Hey, Tim, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
So excited to get you in because we've known each other for a while. The 2009 global financial crisis was a big turning point for both of us. And we both have similar-ish backgrounds, having done a commerce degree at UNSW. So I'm really excited to just learn about your journey. Like, where did it all start for you?
Public school education in Sydney all the way through. So shout out to North Sydney Boys, number one school in New South Wales now. So
that's right. Oh my God, it's taken over James Roos.
That's right. I like to say the small part I played in setting the foundations for the students 20 years later. No, just kidding. Yeah, public school at North Sydney Boys, UNSW, commerce degree. It was a double degree with marketing, tourism and hospitality management. So it was a great degree. We got to do like wine tasting and work in hotels and stuff as part of the degree. That gave me the opportunity to get an internship at Macquarie Bank.
All right.
Yeah, there was like this like UNSW jobs forum and it was like, hey, there's like this finance company and they are doing joint ventures with Greg Norman and Steve Waugh and they're building golf courses and cricket stadiums and all this kind of stuff. And they're also investing into hotels. And so I was like, oh, well, I did a hospitality degree. I got the internship, which is really lucky. And so I ended up working in investment banking and my results were nowhere near as good as the people who were sort of applying for the graduate roles. So they were all a bit like, a job working at Macquarie Bank.
Yeah, I just want to give context to like everyone else. Like the public schools that we went to were selective schools and it's like very competitive to get in. Once you're in there, it's pretty competitive as well. And then all you want to do is like get into like these degrees. And one of the pinnacles of like success for people was to go to Macquarie Bank and get a graduate role.
But it's really, really hard, right? Like you had to have gotten like high distinction.
It's a pinnacle, I think. Like one of the investment banks. But yeah.
That's right. I did a marketing degree. I didn't even do a finance degree. So worked at Macquarie, ended up staying there for about 5 years, and it was a great experience. I think I didn't really realize it at the time, but we were going through the absolute sort of zenith of the last economic cycle. So
that was when it was called the millionaire factory.
Yeah, that's right. Like you had like, 20 something year old people getting million dollar bonuses.
Yeah, and then when my husband joined, sorry to get to what your punchline is, that it does the global financial crisis hits. He's like, oh, now I'm joining the hundreds thousands air factory.
It doesn't quite have the same ring to it, right? So, yeah, I felt fortunate to have felt the back end of that. Mm. But, you know, about 4 years into it, GFC, and that was, you know, a quite visceral memory that I've got of them doing the layoffs, because it was sort of a big screen where somebody comes up onto a screen and goes, hey, today's the day that we're doing layoffs.
Oh, my God.
And the way that they did it, look, it's hard to do it at scale.
Yeah.
Because they were getting rid of a lot of people at the same time. But it was effectively cancel all your meetings for the day. Just sit at your desk. And if your phone rings, you'll have a meeting and we'll discuss your future in the company.
Yeah.
You know, which was the nice way of saying you're gone if your phone rings. And so, you know, it was really quite harrowing to see people, their phone ring and they're like, like I'm out. And for some people, it was very, very emotional because Macquarie, I think, had very, very long tenure up until that point. Yeah. They hadn't really done a lot of layoffs, I don't think. And so people had been there for, you know, 5, 10, 15 years. And so it's pretty brutal. For me as a 25-year-old, it was a great thing, though, because you get a bit of a paycheck and it was a great opportunity to go to something
5 years. That's great.
Yeah.
So was it like daunting or scary for you?
I was one of the few people that was sort of waiting for it and hoping for it. And so when I got it, I was kind of like, high five. Some of the managers and stuff, they were like, oh, are you okay? And I was like, this is the best thing ever. Here's my business card. Give me your business card. And, and it was great.
That entrepreneurial optimism, I think.
Yeah, I was more like, hey, I'm getting a check. I've now got, you know, I can go try a bunch of other things.
And
I think the main thing for me after that was I try to create some sort of like structure and discipline around my life, even after you lose your job. So I actually called up a friend and said, hey, can I come and hang out at your office? And, you know, I'll come in every day and I'll make my job getting a new job. Went swimming every day and I did all the things I couldn't do when you were doing investment banking. And so it was great.
Yeah. You're like, oh, hot girl summer. Let me just make the most of it. In 2009, I had a business that failed, which is why I started Shopo, because I quit my job for it. So my ex-business partner was working at KPMG in a cadetship program, as was I, as was Tim's wife. She, for this whole time I've known her while we were at UNSW doing this cadetship, all she wanted to do was get into Macquarie Bank. That's all she talked about. She was like, let's go to the round house. Let's go out. She's like, no, I've got exams. I'm going to get into Macquarie Bank. Yeah. And she did. And it was like, whoa, that is amazing. You're at Macquarie Bank. She works there for a year and I become friends with all her Macquarie Bank crew. I really kind of felt the redundancies because it was like, I kind of knew the cohort and it was like, oh wow, this person didn't make it. This person did. It was like, kind of felt it. Anyway, so when she got made redundant, that was a huge, huge moment for her because that's everything she's been working towards, like ever since I've known her, ever since she probably set her goals onto it. And so I guess she had a bit of a chip on her shoulder when that happened to prove herself. And so that's why she started the business. And then she just like looped me in. I'm like, okay, let's do it.
Right,
and if it wasn't for that, I would have never started Shopo. So that's how that was a sliding door.
You just got to go with it,
like,
right?
Moment.
Like,
yeah.
You know, things that appear to be bad might end up being good.
Yeah.
Could also be the things that seem to be good aren't that good.
Yeah.
So yeah, you just got to go with
it. So anyway, I don't normally talk about myself like this much in the start of a podcast, but I just thought that was a really cool coincidence that we had. So what did you do next?
I had a couple of friends who were working in a small business. So I said, can I rent an office in your place? And I went swimming every day at Pimble Pool. I decided I was going to do something super ostentatious, which is I made a brochure about myself. And I said, I really want to work in talent representation. So I was watching a lot of like Entourage and I was like, Ari Gold is awesome. I'd love to work in like the celebrity representation field. And so I thought, you know, in order to get in here, I'm going to have to be good at marketing myself. So rather than just doing a resume, I did this like 20-page brochure, which talked about all of my interests and, you know, achievements and stuff, which weren't that much at that stage. I sent it out to a lot of the different talent rep agencies in Australia. And, you know, it's a smaller industry here, obviously, than the United States. But I was really lucky because Ursula Hufnagel, who runs a company called Chic Management.
Yeah, which is huge.
Yeah, it's a big fashion agency. She was the one person who sort of responded to me and said, I'll come in and it's a bit weird, but, you know, I'll have a chat with you. And I basically went in there and said, I'll do whatever you want me to do for no money. And so she's well, can't really say no to that. So
yeah.
I ended up just doing a lot of PowerPoint presentations for them, which, you know, after working at Macquarie for 5 years,
that was
my thing. They were like, wow, your PowerPoint is like really good. And so, you know, when we would like make up a PowerPoint about one of their celebrities, Michelle Bridges or Miranda Kerr or one of these people, my PowerPoints looked really good. So that's why I got to stay there for a while.
Well, I can't believe that. Like, to make a brochure about yourself at that, it's like to it's have kind of
terrible.
It's so cool. It's like, that's ballsy.
It's cringeworthy now. If do I look back at it, I still. I actually printed about like 100 of them. So I actually have boxes of these brochures. And I must say, we chose, like, the paper was chosen. We chose a fine grain GSM? Yeah, like 150 GSM paper. And we printed it with offset printing and all this kind of stuff. So it's cringeworthy now, but it was a good move at the time, I guess.
That is awesome. How long did it take for you to get hired?
So first of all, like, I totally agree with that premise. And I do think it's something that, you know, young people should be thinking about, which is like, just, you know, do stuff for people for free. Don't worry about getting paid or whatever. Like, honestly, the experience is just, that's the currency.
And you're paying and to invest network. In yourself. The cost is your time. Totally. You're investing in yourself.
And when you really think about the money that you may or may not make, you know, if you get paid $50,000 or $60,000 a year and it's 3 months, that's probably not the best. Now, that's a pretty privileged statement because I was living at home. So I was like, that's fine. You know, not everyone's in that position. But if you can, I think it is a good move. What I did is just spent 3 months literally chaperoning celebs to like events, doing these PowerPoint presentations and just doing, you know, whatever crappy work, you know, I was asked to do. Like, and it was literally like chaperone this person, i.e. do whatever they say, get them coffee, all that sort of thing. You know, I had a ball doing that.
Yeah. What were your parents like? Because they were like, you were, oh my God, he went to the North Sydney Boys, he went to UNSW, he got this, he's at Macquarie Bank, and now he's like working for free for a talent agency, which I just think for like Asian parents, like, it's not something like selling clothes, it's not something they would recognize, you know? Like,
yeah, so look, I was pretty lucky. I think, obviously, look, Chinese, I'm Chinese heritage, but my mother is actually fourth generation Australian. So on my mum's side of the family, it's a very Aussie and sort of liberal way of thinking. Like they were very big on do well in the HSC and study and stuff. For some reason, the HSC was the main thing for them. And once that was done, it was like freedom. My dad was born in Hong Kong. And so potentially has a bit more traditional views, but my mum's probably the one who's coaching me more on that sort of stuff. And, you know, after I'd done sort of, you know, the Macquarie thing, I think they'd tick that box and they were kind of okay with me.
Because they kind of probably felt like you've got enough experience and a degree to fall back on.
Also, I didn't ask them that much.
Yeah.
So, you know, they might have had views on that, but I didn't really ask them for those views. And, you know, they did give me the freedom to do what I wanted to do. So I was pretty happy with that.
That's awesome.
Basically, hanging out at this celebrity agency, having a lot of fun, still not getting paid. But then I met, and this is just luck, I guess, the co-owner of the agency was an executive who had been big at, actually had some senior roles in Macquarie, at Babcock & Brown, had done a lot of telco type work. In fact, he was one of the founding directors of Optus in Australia.
Wow.
So a really seasoned person who happened to half own this Molly agency. And so he had just finished up a gig running Aircom, which is the Irish telco. And he'd come back to Australia and he was like, this is pretty weird, like comes to the Molly agency and I'm the only one wearing like a button-up shirt and, you know, looking like a nerd basically and sticking out. And she's like, who's this? And I met him and he was like, hey, I want to go and do a bunch of stuff. So I need an analyst, you know, will you do it? And I'll pay you. And I was like, oh, that's great. I'm going to get paid again. And so he got me working and we worked on probably 6 or 7 different projects in the space of 3 months. So yeah, it was pretty fortunate, you know, to get that gig. But I think he probably did have the respect for this person's working for me for free. You know, there must be something in this.
Yeah.
But he really gave me the opportunity.
That's awesome. And then so that evolved into Amazon. How did that happen?
So Peter O'Connell is a super smart guy and had a lot of different interests. So we looked at doing like an oil and gas fund together. We looked at starting like a reality TV show for models using all the, you know, the model talent that we had. We looked at all these things. But the thing that he had jumped on was he'd been in Europe and he'd met these 4 German guys who'd started basically online only mobile. And if you kind of cast your mind back to like 2008, 2009, it's still sort of a growing industry. And, you know, people are still getting ripped off with mobile phone plan. You know, some people are paying like $150 a month for the same thing as someone else paying $50 a month. The first thing they asked me to do is like, do an assessment of the pricing in the mobile industry.
Yeah.
And so basically when you did all the pricing of different plans, you literally could not come up with a standardized way of comparing plans because they'd make it so complicated that you just couldn't tell. So he'd been to Germany, he'd seen these 4 men set up this business in Germany, which was basically all you get is a SIM card. You buy the SIM card, and then it's a price per minute. That's the only thing you need to know. It's 9 cents a minute and it's a dollar for the SIM card or something. And you can only buy it on the internet. What we did is we convinced those people to move to Australia and we got them to recut the deal with the telco and raised a lot of money and helped build that business again in Australia, which was amazing.
Wow. That's like so cool in itself. That's like, that could be the end. That's end of part one, guys. See you next week.
It was really cool because the first job that he gave me was convince the four founders.
And how did you do that?
To Australia. Well, he gave me his credit card and he goes,
Do you want to dine them? What did you do?
Yeah, he goes like, I've got them here for a week. We need to, you know, do a series of workshops to figure out what the business is going to be.
Yeah.
But we've also got to convince them, their wives, they had like nine kids.
Oh, wow.
Some of them had horses and farms and stuff like this. Oh, my God. And we've got to convince them all to come to Australia. And so, yeah, I got the credit card and I was like, oh, well, we're going to have to do one of the workshops on a boat on the harbour. Yeah. We're going to have to do another one in the Hunter Valley.
Yeah.
And so that was kind of the dream.
There's your tourism degree coming into handy.
That's right, yeah.
What did you learn from that experience?
The number one most memorable thing that I learned during that period was about seeing things through end to end. I remember Peter, who's my mentor, said, hey, we're doing this presentation with these German founders. And we're going to do it at this hotel. And so I said, great, I've booked a room and we're going to go and do it. And when we got there, there was no screen and there was no projector. He actually flipped it at me and he was like, where's the overhead projector? Why didn't you bring an overhead projector, you know, or like a projector machine there? And I was like, oh, I feel like that's hard to anticipate that they wouldn't have a screen and I need, but he's like, think about things through end to end. You need to just make it happen. Just make it happen. And that did really make... Great.
My assistant's in the room. I'm like, you need to take notes.
Well, that was the thing. It's like good management and good execution, I think, is you think about all this. Like if you can actually visualize, we're going to go in this room, we're going to screen. Who's got the screen? You know, that's something that would pop up. And I think good management and experience management is anticipate that and execute well. Real ownership, you can't say, oh, someone else should have thought of that. It's like there is no one else. It's just you.
Yeah.
Do it. So I think that was a funny but interesting lesson, which, and at the time I felt it was unfair feedback, but in hindsight, I'm like, no, that was like the greatest thing ever.
Yeah. And so Amazim listed.
Started building it in 2009, launched in 2010. Jono and I, the two, my co-founder at Airtasker and first two employees at Amazim, we left the business in like 2012. Then Amazim went on to list in 2015.
Right. So. That's incredible. And so anything exciting happened in 2012 that that was the catalyst?
For starting Airtasker?
Yeah.
Look, I think Jono and I had a ball building Amazim from scratch. Like we had to go do a deal with Optus. We had to build the entire sort of infrastructure around the business. We hired like 150 people in, you know, 6 months or something. And it was a really exciting journey to do that. But once it was built, it became like a BAU. You just got to keep grinding away at adding more subscribers and doing good marketing and things like that. And we were kind of like not up for doing all of that.
Yeah. So, were you kind of like seeing a business just being created? You're kind of like, oh, you can just create a business. Because I felt like that from my, even though my failed business, I was like, oh, you can just start a business? Like totally. You can just go and do it?
in that sense, definitely. It was like, oh, so like PowerPoint, raise money, go do something. That sounds cool. Like that's doable. I think in some sense, it was great to open your eyes to that. In another sense, it was massively oversimplified when you weren't the founder.
Yeah.
I think, you know, I now look back at some of the things that were, because sometimes the founders would be like, we're just going to have a meeting with just the founders. And then, you know, we'll come out and tell you what we need you to execute on. You know, some of those things were like, look, we need to like tighten up our costs and we need to, you know, make a bit more revenue. We might need to raise a bit more money. But if you kind of think about what was probably going on behind the scenes before that comes out, it's probably someone pulling their hair out going, oh my God, we're running out of money.
We've got 6 months left. Look at our burn rate.
So there were certain things that I didn't quite appreciate until I did it myself. But yeah, it was definitely a good eye-opener.
Hey PolyFam, I've got something special for you. For a limited time only, I have a discount code for my business course. In case you didn't know, the course is a blueprint for starting an online business and growing it to 7 or 8 figures. It's 10 modules of videos that you can watch at your own pace, covering everything from sourcing product, growing and developing your product range, operations, and marketing and scaling your business. Just use the code PODCAST at checkout at thelazyceo.com.
Where did the idea for Airtasker start?
I was moving apartments, asked my mate Ivan to come and help me move. And this is just like something you have to do a lot in your 20s, you know, when you're moving, you know, between different apartments. I was actually moving out from a place with like four of my friends to, you know, finally getting an apartment with my now wife. And so I asked Ivan to help me move. And that just made us think, you know, why is it that you would ask your friends and family to do something that's really annoying for them?
Yeah.
You know, like he's busy, he's got his own business. Why is it that we do that when you could go and get somebody else to do that who actually wants to do that?
Yeah.
And it wasn't really a money thing. And so what we kind of realized is it's mostly a trust thing. It's actually really hard to go and find someone, you know, just off the streets that you would trust enough to, you know, come and help move all of your things. And around about the same time, you know, social, like LinkedIn and Facebook was actually making the migration from, I guess, pseudonyms to real life social networks. So if you remember like back in, even like up to like 08, it wasn't really people using Facebook as much as they were using like forums and these different things where they would have pseudonyms and fake stuff. But we were like with Facebook and LinkedIn and those things becoming identity, more real. Like you should be able to stitch together enough trust to be able to find someone to go and do a job for you like that. That was where we started. I think as we went on that journey, a lot of the mission and what we do as a business now evolved along the way. And I think it's a really good point because a lot of people, I think that founders sort of just sitting at home one day and then they're like, you know what? I need to empower people to realize the full value of their skills. Therefore, I'm going to go build a business. And usually it doesn't start that way. Usually it's like, oh, wouldn't it be cool if we could do like five tasks? That'd be cool. And then, you know, you kind of start on that journey and then, you know, it evolves into more than that over time.
Like a really good idea starts with like the problem first.
It's usually something simple that you just want to fix in your day-to-day life.
Because when I look at a business and a great business, I'm like, oh, why didn't I think of that first? I feel like, oh my God, no one's doing this. We should totally do it. And then so it's really cool where it is now because like just jumping ahead, I feel like you've created your own term. AirTasket has a meaning. Like it's become like a verb. Kleenex is tissue or like Ubering is like, that means something. With the marketplace, it kind of needs to be a winner takes all market.
Look, there's definitely network effects. The main part of the product is actually like the community. And that's not just like, I'm not sort of just playing platitudes to the people who use our platform, but genuinely on AirTasker, the core part of the value is it's a place where people go to post the jobs and that creates a job opportunity for the people on the other side of that, the market, the taskers, and vice versa. By having active taskers with built out profiles, it makes it a place where you want to post your jobs because you know you're going to find that person. It is largely a network effect business, which means we did know from the beginning you have to build scale. You can't run a boutique version of a business like this. And so that was probably one of the big challenges because a lot of the common, I guess, education around how to start a startup is like, oh, do it for one customer, get it right, and then do it for five, and then do it for 100, and then eventually you might end up with 1 million customers. But in a network effect business, you kind of just have to quickly get to 1 million customers. So that's a tricky part of starting
businesses. So what was the biggest challenges to get it up and running in the first place? And then how did you get your first customer?
It is a little bit like infrastructure. We kind of had to just build out the software parts of the product very, very quickly. That wasn't too hard to do. Jono, my co-founder, is an engineer. So he was, you know, able to direct all the people who were doing all the programming. And, you know, we knew what we needed to build technically. The hard part was building the community or what we call liquidity to build up a network effect. You know, this was really, really freaking hard. We started out with a run rate of around about 20 tasks a day. And even that was really hard to do, you know, to get 20 people a day to just say, I would like my house cleaned or
Because you had to change human behavior. For me, with AirTasker, it was, I had a good income because Chopo was at a certain size. We were building like IKEA furniture and we had this like big fight. And then we got friends to come in and help us. And then we were like, why didn't we put this on AirTasker? And then from that moment, we started AirTasking everything.
You've got to click for people.
And
that, I think that is people. Why it takes a long time. Look, it's a hard business to build. I would definitely say this would be difficulty hard if you were to look at a kind of business to build, which, you know, if you told me there was an easier business, I probably would have chosen that. But it was definitely, you had to be at scale immediately or growing scale very, very rapidly. It was total change in behavior. And then inherently, AirTasker requires work from the customer. You know, as a customer, you've actually kind of got to articulate, this is what I need done. Now, that might sound simple, But it is a hard thing. It's different to, you know, say Uber, where you just press a button and it just happens.
Yeah. If you're not used to managing and giving instructions, people are actually really bad at it. That's why, like, lots of people don't use ChatGPT properly because they don't know how to use prompts.
Yes. You know? like, so it's like a, that's why I think, you know, entrepreneurs and founders and stuff were some of the early adopters to Airtasker because, you know, they were forced delegating. Articulating what they needed. That was all really hard. I think one of the things we've learned in hindsight is that
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Although it is a two-sided marketplace, the proposition to taskers is so good that's not something that we had to put a lot of effort into solving. The product inherently did that. Because if you look at a tasker, your alternative is to like basically build your own website and then do your own advertising and marketing. And that's really hard and it's risky. Like, you know, if you think about Hipages or all of these different kinds of products, you've got to pay up front. You pay and then they kind of go, well, the risk is on you. If you get something out of this, good on you. But either way, you pay. Whereas what Airtasker says is, look at all the jobs, see all the people, have all the opportunity in the world. It's all for free. If you make some money, we're going to take a cut of that money. And I think that takes all the risk away for taskers. Mm-hmm. And so the proposition on that side of the market is basically turn up at this platform, get everything that you get on these other websites, but get it for free. Only pay when you make money and you can start instantly. So like right now, if you need money, you can go in and do this. And now that we're at scale, it's basically like any skill that you've got, you could basically make some money on Airtasker using that skill.
Awesome. So then how did you scale it up?
Incredibly slowly. Okay. So it was literally like, you know, if you look at the chart, it's kind of terrible because yesterday we did 17 jobs. That's less than 20. Are you telling me that we've been working on this for 6 months? And that's because like, if you look at the daily fluctuations, it's generally, you know, it's 20, 30, 16. That was really hard, but there was no one silver bullet. We did, you know, everything from paid marketing, SEO, CRM, like email marketing, building out integrations and apps, partnerships. And then eventually we did this media partnership with Channel 7. And that was a big move for us because that was really how we went from, you know, being a bit more of a hokey kind of niche product to being more of a well-known, you know, brand in Australia. So that was a big move for us.
What did the partnership entail?
They basically invested in Airtasker in exchange for ads. So, you know, they gave us cash as well, but it was basically like, hey, we'll give you millions of dollars of advertising space, but we get to own 20% of Airtasker. Mm-hmm. That was really good for us. We took that opportunity and we went pretty hard with it, like invested a lot into making a good TV ad. And then we just hammered that home. And I think one of the contrarian things that we said is TV is a declining channel, like linear TV is declining, but we don't care about the decline. We just care about who the audience is today.
Yeah, exactly.
And
yeah,
so I think what's interesting is that in growing channels, you're generally paying a premium for the future, but you're not really reaping any of the benefits of that. For example, I guess in, you know, TikTok is a platform which is really scaling, but you're kind of paying a premium because everyone thinks that's the new place to be.
Yeah, yeah.
Whereas if you're in a declining channel, you're probably getting somewhat of a discount because people are like, oh, no, I've got to start working on TikTok.
Yeah.
And so things like TV becomes cheaper. And I think in marketing, the game is to be contrarian because if you're going where everyone else is going, you know, you're probably going to get competed out.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And this is where you can find like kind of like an arbitrage opportunity for like just like a little hack to
Do something like, you know, I would say, you know, outdoor marketing, you know, sometimes people think that's not, you know, a growing channel, but, you know, doing some of these things that are a bit different for your category is probably a good thing.
Yeah, I remember we had like Jimmy Brings on the podcast. He was like, our big thing was fridge magnets.
Yeah.
I'm like, oh my God. Yeah, because that's when you're like, oh, we've got no beers left.
Yeah, how good is that? I love the fridge magnet.
Yeah.
I actually think the UK and the US, they don't really do the fridge magnet thing. I think it's quite an Aussie thing. And so when we went to the UK and we're like, oh, you know, plumbers, you know, it's just like a fridge magnet. You know, you want to keep reminding people, you know, if you're a plumber, about using, you know, Airtasker. And they were like, what are you talking about, fridge magnets?
Yeah, like, yeah, that's what you put in your little tourist. Yeah, right. Yeah. What's the laziest thing you've seen someone Airtask? I had a friend pay $50 for like ciggies on New Year's Day. I've seen that. I've also had a friend that Airtasked for like KFC before there was Uber Eats. Have you seen some of these and been like, what the hell?
It's really hard to tell about people's motivations. And I'm not saying this just to, again, play platitudes to our users and community. But generally, when you look behind some of these things, it's actually usually genius and entrepreneurialism as opposed to laziness.
Yeah.
If someone could figure that out, you're like, that's amazing.
You're outsourcing this
genuinely,
thing.
Most people don't use Airtasker because of laziness. Like, most people are using it because
convenience.
They want to do more or they want to do more.
Well, yeah,
like, they're kind of like, I could do this, but if I actually got someone else to do that, then I can go do this.
Yeah.
And I think that's inherent to the product because you actually do have to work with someone. Mm. Working with people takes some effort. And we find that the people who are most successful on Airtasker are the people who love to manage and work with people and support them to do stuff. So, yeah, it's less laziness and probably more like genius, actually.
Yeah. How about the getting funding process? How was it in those early days? Because I think like 2012 was pretty early on.
Yeah, so there was no real VC scene in Australia. But, oh, look, I've got to be careful because people who were back then in 2012 go, there was absolutely a scene, but it wasn't anywhere.
It's
like, there wasn't Blackbird and, Square Peg and Airtree and, you know, all of these people. It's pretty nascent. We were fortunate because we'd been on the team that raised money for Amazim. And so we had a couple of prominent Australian angel investors who had seen us, you know, for 2-3 years working and building, and they were the first people that we tapped on the shoulder. That was enough to sew together a seed round early on. One of the things that we also uncovered is we didn't really realize how many, like, the sort of German e-commerce effect in Australia. Like, there were all of these people who'd come from Rocket Internet, and then we had bought the guys from Simio and Amazim together, and that network was absolutely enormous Australia.
Yeah.
Daniel Jaroche, you know, people had built a lot of these group buying sites and e-com sites and stuff. So there was a little bit of second generation money that had been made through that. Justus Hammer, who was one of our first investors, he'd made money through selling Spreets to Channel 7. The first round was very much like just thread it together from any angel investor that you could sort of find. And we were lucky that we'd had the network from Amazim.
So how was the juggling, I guess, growing the business? Because, you know, I think a lot of founders can get tight, bogged down during the fundraising part of it. Like, how did you find the balance?
Well, I'd say for about 6 years, it was a large part of the job. Each year I can sort of like characterize by having to do a round and it feeling like a crisis every time that you needed to go and do a round. I was really lucky in the sense that my co-founder was much better operationally and execution-wise than I was. So, you know, he was running engineering, he was running customer service, the basics of finance and all those kinds of things. And that let me go out and do the job of raising the money. But it was hard. Like, every year we basically had to pull a rabbit out of a hat to try and raise money. And I think particularly for the type of product we were building, it was hard because it was a local business, mainly Australian customers, but you kind of needed US quantities of money to keep funding the business.
Yeah,
and that was pretty hard because you'd go to the US and they'd be like, who are you? Never heard of this business, not going to fund you. Mm-hmm. But you'd go to Australia and they'd be like, oh, we can't write a check for $25 million. Like, we can only write a check for $2 million or something. And so that put us in a bit of a rock and a hard place. I think that ultimately in 2019 got us into a really, you know, a forced situation though, which was get profitable.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was really, you know, it was a hard lesson.
In your fourth year, so like 2016, like, why did you have to, like, were your investors on your back?
We started 2012 and we had raised around every year until 2019. So we'd been raising just bigger and bigger and bigger rounds, and the burn rate was just going up and up and up and up. Mm-hmm. 2019, we're burning about $2 million a month. We had less than $15 million in the bank. So we were kind of like 7 months away on that run rate. and we couldn't raise around. I was kind of like, oh, look, we just raised $50 million.
Yeah.
We raised $50 million. We got another 2 years of runway at this burn rate. And, you know, that's where it really hit the crunch of no one in Australia could write a check. Very few people in Australia could write a check for that sort of money.
Mm-hmm.
When you went to the US or the UK, we just didn't have the customers there. So you're too unknown to all of these people and you couldn't raise there either.
Yeah.
Which is different to, say, like a Canva or a safety culture where you've actually got customers in those countries using the product.
And it's a global product.
It's a global product. We didn't have a global product. And so basically it was like, well, we're dead in 6 months if we don't get profitable.
Okay, well.
And so I remember just war rooming that, which is like, okay, well, what's got to go and what's got to stay? And fortunately, we didn't really have to let go of many people. Mm-hmm. It was mostly get the marketing to be a lot more efficient. Do one thing, which is give a shit about pricing. I think that's one of the biggest things that, it's particularly like software founders and stuff, it's an afterthought. It's like, oh, $99 a month. I don't know. That seems fair. $29 a month, whatever. It's like there's a 10% revenue difference between $29 a month and $31.90 a month.
Like, yes.
The difference in that is 10% of your revenue. And if you're doing $10 million of revenue, that's $1 million.
Yeah.
That's 10 people's salaries.
Yeah.
Give a shit about $29 versus $31.90. If customers are telling you, I'll pay $31.90, you're like, take it.
Because
we did a big one, which, you know, we just reviewed all of our pricing and our fees and stuff like that. We did a lot of fee studies and pricing was, so it was really get efficient on marketing, stop doing too many things, focus the team on just doing a couple of things and look at pricing. And we actually ended up getting cash flow positive in 9 months. So from 2 million to cash flow positive in 9 months, we didn't think that. It was actually really depressing when we decided that we were going to go on the journey to profitability. We're like, our CFO was pretty conservative. And they're like, yep, so we should be there in about 2.5 years. Wow. And we're like, keeping a team motivated where it's like, we're going to be spending less and doing less.
And you're competing with other tech businesses that just blow money. Yeah. Like
they're like, how come the guys up the road are actually, you know,
they've got free lunches, you know, and they've got these like sleeping pods.
That's true. And you know, for us, I think the one thing we did have is a product that people genuinely cared about. And because it's easy to understand. And, but I think it's also that you can touch and feel Airtasker to some degree. Whereas I think if you were in a B2B SaaS that sells stuff to marketing agencies, it's harder to be inspired by,
like,
you know,
people get excited. I remember my husband working at Uber, like when we're in like a social scene, him and his like Uber workers, we're like, oh my God, they're talking about Uber again. They're like, and we're like, oh, Uber, like stop. They, you know, they just get so excited about the product. They're like, these people are already taking Ubers. Stop trying to sell people Uber. Like it's, you know, like people just get like something you can get passionate about.
Yeah.
But like the path to profitability for like a tech business, especially like a marketplace, is it's so hard. Did that really help set you up for COVID? Like what was COVID like?
Yeah, so the first thing is I think that it was a real blessing in disguise having to get profitable in 2019 because COVID came around.
Could people do jobs?
Well, we basically saw a 35% decline like day on day when the lockdown sort of came. So we were kind of freaking out. And I remember sitting down with
just got profitable.
Yeah, and we're like, that's the downside of profitability is your revenue pays for everything. So if your revenue goes down, you know, you're not profitable anymore. We thought it was going to go to zero. Like genuinely, we're like, because if they're just locking people in their houses. Yeah. But this is when we realized how adaptive the product is. Because it's all user-generated content, we don't define the tasks. Customers define the tasks, and then taskers meet the demands of customers. It self-regulates.
Right.
And so during COVID, all the domestic cleaning disappeared, but things emerged. Like people would be like, oh, I want an online fitness instructor. Or I need someone to set up my home IT because my work has shipped me all of this stuff, you know, but I need to set up a home office and connect all the routers up and all that kind of thing. We did see this sort of 35% reduction, but then it just started building. And look, I think the last couple of years has certainly been rough in terms of, you know, going straight from COVID to basically a bit of a tech wreck and then interest rates going up. So I don't want to lie, it's been hard. Definitely the way that our product works and the way the community works, it's self-adapting to those kinds of things. And with a lot of hard work, we've been able to keep driving growth and keep getting to new milestones, but it's been hard.
Hey, Potty fam, you can probably tell that I absolutely love talking to Tim and he has such a wealth of knowledge. Join us for more in part two, where Tim shares some of his hustle stories from those early days, how COVID surprisingly pivoted and helped expand Airtasker, and how they achieved profitability.
Okay, that's it from me for now. Thanks for listening. And if you're loving the podcast, don't forget to leave us a review. And if you want more, join the conversation on the podcast Instagram at thelazyceo_podcast. Link to the show notes. Catch you next Tuesday.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.